TheYeshiva.net.
Welcome, everybody. Thank you for gracing us with your presence this morning. Today's class is gratefully dedicated by Esther Rus Shalom and her family living in Eretz Yisrael in tribute to our Israeli army and all of the volunteer organizations helping our brothers and sisters during this time of crisis. Am Yisrael Chai. Thank you very much, Rebbetzin Esther, and regards to our Holy Land, and a lot of bracha and atzlacha. I want to begin the class with a story that happened recently. There's a Jew by the name of Rebbe Elisha Lowenstern. Rebbe Elisha Lowenstern was 38 years old. He made aliyah with his family from New Jersey, Highland Park, New Jersey, at the age of 8, grew up in Beit Shemesh, lived in Israel in a town called Harish, and very successful software engineer, and also a Talmud Chacham. Every free moment he sat and learned. In fact, his wife shared, he would do his exercise routines, and sometimes there's like a 30-second break between one routine and another routine. He had a Mishnayos there. And while catching his breath, he didn't waste those 30 seconds or minute between one routine and another routine and was learning Mishnayos. Elisha was killed in Gaza just in the month of Tevis. He was killed on Rosh Chodesh Tevis, December 13th. He was 38 years old, and he left his wife, Hadass Lowenstern, and 6 children, ages 10 months to 12 years old. He was preparing his 12-year-old, his oldest, for his bar mitzvah coming up. And he was actually in Gaza, and he was on a mission to rescue wounded soldiers to be able to give them the medical care they needed and save their lives. And actually, at this point, he was exempt from army service, but he felt that it was his duty to defend his people, his homeland, his brothers and sisters, and he volunteered for service. He was a pillar of his community in Harish, and as I said, in Rosh Chodesh Tevis, he was killed by an anti-tank missile fired by Hamas, Yimach Shemam V'Zichram. And actually, as what I read the story was, that he saw that his unit was in danger, and he jumped in order to save them, and saved many of them, but he was killed. So this happened, as I said, Rosh Chodesh Tevis. Close to 2 months later, another Jew, happens to be a friend of mine, his name is Shalom Goodman, he's an editor in the Wall Street Journal, lives in Brooklyn in New York, had a baby boy, and the bris was just a few weeks ago, Erev Rosh Chodesh Adar Aleph, and he and his wife decided to name the baby after Elisha. There's no family connection, there's no acquaintance, there's no relationship, not even knowledge, but his wife, Liach, shared that when she read the story and she knew she's soon giving birth, she just felt that she wants to name her baby for this man. So he named him David Elisha for David HaMelech, who was also quite a warrior. David Melech is all Chai V'Kaim, and for Elisha Lowenstern. Shalom is a friend of mine, so he shared with me the good news that he had a baby by email, that he had a baby with a picture of him holding his new baby. And the decision they made, and the bris. So I wrote a note to him, and I said, make sure to call Hadass Lowenstern and tell her. He didn't think of it. You know, she's an almana with 6 kids, a lot going on in Israel. This was something he did. So he reached out to her. Him and his wife both reached out to her, and they shared with her the news. It happens to be, Hadass shared, that every single Rosh Chodesh, her husband, bought her a gift. Every single Rosh Chodesh for the new month, her husband went and bought her a gift. So he sent me back what she wrote back to Shalom and his wife, the new mother and father. I have no words really. May Hashem bless you and your family. May you always know simcha in your life. A huge hug to my David Elisha. I'm looking forward to meet him and to your wife too. I have no words to tell you how meaningful this is for me. The best Rosh Chodesh present that I received from my husband. This was the Rosh Chodesh. She couldn't receive a gift, but she received a baby named after her husband, continuing his legacy for eternity until Chiyas HaMesim. So Shalom sent this to me, and I wanted to share this with you today. It actually captures one of the themes we're going to be addressing today. This week is, of course, Parshas Vayakel. Usually, very often, Vayakel and Pekudei, the two last portions of Shmos. I'm going to translate in English because some people hear the class and they don't know all the Hebrew words, so you'll forgive me not to underestimate the level of knowledge of the people here, but just it's a broad audience that watches or listens. I want everybody to be able to understand. So the book of Shmos, the book of Exodus, the last two portions are called Vayakel and Pekudei. Usually they're read together. But this year, it's one of those years, a leap year, that the Vayakel and Pekudei are separate. So this week we read Vayakel, and only next week do we read Pekudei. This week is also the Shabbos that blesses Rosh Chodesh Adar Sheni. In other words, it's the Shabbos before the first day, Rosh Chodesh, the first day of the second month of Adar, which is going to be on Sunday. So it's also Shabbos Mevarachim Chodesh Adar, and therefore we read a separate portion after the Parsha. We read what's called Parshas Shkalim. Parshas Shkalim is a very short Parsha. It's the beginning of Kisisa, which is actually the previous portion right before Vayakel, only the first section of it, the first few paragraphs. It's called Parshas Shkalim because it speaks about the Shkalim. Shkalim were coins that were contributed each year by every Jew as charity for the Beis HaMikdash, for the Holy Temple. So why do we read it on this Shabbos, even though it's not part of the order? And the answer is because in the time of the Beis HaMikdash, in the time of the Holy Temple, the Jewish people used to donate every single year a half shekel. Everyone donated a half shekel, what's called a machtzis shekel, the common coin that was used, the standard coin that was used by the community, by the population in that time, a half of it. Machtzis shekel, a half of it. And because of that, because everyone donated this, they had the money to be able to purchase all of the offerings throughout the entire year. Somebody had to pay for it. All the karbanas, there were individual offerings that people brought, but the karbanas sib were the communal offerings. Where was that purchased from? That didn't represent one Jew or a family, or it represented every Jew. Every day there were public communal offerings that were brought every single day, and Shabbos, and Yom Tov, and Rosh Chodesh. These were acts of service done on behalf of the entire Jewish people, so everyone had a part in it. How did everybody have a part in it? By donating a machtzis shekel, a half of shekel. This was sent to Jerusalem, to Yerushalayim. It was kept in a special chamber, a treasury, in the Beis HaMikdash. And that Alishka was called, a special room. And from there, they took the money to buy all of the offerings that were done throughout the year in the Beis HaMikdash. Again, not the individual offerings that you paid for on your own, but the public communal ones. And there were a lot of them, whether meal offerings or animal offerings, wine libations, etc. When was the time that they used to start using the new funds that came in? Rosh Chodesh Nissan. The Torah teaches Rosh Chodesh Nissan, the first day of Nissan, that was the time they began using the new funds, the new shkalim that came in. When would they start collecting them? Rosh Chodesh Adar. The Mishnah says, Be'echad ba'adar mashmi'in ala shkalim. On the first day of Adar, they start announcing that it's time to send your annual donation to the spiritual epicenter of the Jewish people, the epicenter of the Jewish land and the Jewish capital city, Yerushalayim, which was the Beis HaMikdash. The first day of Adar, the announcements were made, and then during the month, the funds were collected so they can arrive on time to Yerushalayim, to Jerusalem, to the Beis HaMikdash. Today, we don't have a Beis HaMikdash, and nobody's collecting shkalim, but the Shabbos, before the first day of Adar, when everyone is in shul, we also announce about it. So how do we announce? We read the Parsha Shkalim. We read the portion that deals with the mitzvah of Jews giving this donation for the service in, then it was the Mishkan and the Tabernacle, and later in the Beis HaMikdash. That's why this Shabbos, we don't only read Vayakel, we also read Shkalim. If we take a look, the first in your source sheet, by the way, we always post the source sheets on theyeshiva.net, so if anybody wants to download, it'll be posted after the class. You can download it later also. If you see, this is the opening of Kisisa, the opening of the portion of Kisisa. It's Exodus chapter 30, Shmais Perek Lamed, verse 11, Yud Aleph. Vayidaber Hashem al Moshe Lemer, Hashem speaks to Moshe. What does Hashem tell, what does God tell Moses? Kisisa esrosh b'nei Yisrael ifkudeyem. When you want to take a census of the Jewish people, v'nosnu ish kofer nafshel Hashem b'fkoydoysem v'lo yibem negeb b'fkoydoysem. Let everyone give a donation to redeem his soul, and that's how they should be counted. This will avoid any negative consequences, any plague. Ze yitnu, how much do you give? Ze yitnu kol over al apkodim. Anyone who's part of the census, this is what they should give. Machatzis a shekel b'shekel akodesh. A half a shekel from the holy shekel. Meaning, there was a currency called a shekel. This was used for all of the purchases in the Mishkan and the Tabernacle, later in the Beis HaMikdash, was called Shekel HaKadosh. Don't give that shekel. Give a half of that shekel. And he explains, Esrim Geira HaShekel. A whole shekel would be equivalent to 20 Geira. 20 Geira were 20 coins of smaller value. So 20 of those would make up a shekel. And you give Machatzis HaShekel, which would, of course, mean 10 geira. Truma l'Hashem, a donation to Hashem. Kol eved al apkudim menesim shanav amayli yitin truma sashep. This was a commandment at this time from everyone from 20 years and older should give this donation. Asher lo yarbe v'adal lo yamit mimachtis hasheka losses his truma sashem l'chapra al nafshir seich. The wealthy person should not give more. The poor person should not give less from a half a shekel. This is the donation they're giving to Hashem l'chapra al nafshir seichem to atone for your soul. This is the original mitzvah of Machtzis HaShekel, yet in the time of the desert, when the Jewish people gave Machtzis HaShekel the first time when they were building the Mishkan, building the tabernacle, but it became a fixed custom and ritual throughout the generations, year after year after year, where every Jew gave a Machtzis HaShekel, and as I explained, this covered the funds that the Beis HaMikdash needed to run its daily routines and services that were relevant to the entire people. Over here, there's a very famous question that the commentators ask. Just to give a little bit of understanding in contemporary terms, the shekel was basically a silver coin, a minted coin, pure silver, and the value of it was the weight of silver. So the shekel, approximately, it's estimated in today's terms, was approximately 16 grams of silver. And a half a shekel, therefore, would be 8 grams of silver. So if you took a coin called Machtzis HaShekel and you weighed it, it was basically pure silver. It was 8 grams, approximately 8 grams of pure silver. I think today's price, it would be somewhere between $8 and $10. 8 grams, $8. A full shekel would be double of that. But the obligation was not. Even if you were wealthy, you couldn't give a whole shekel. That wasn't accepted. Only a Machtzis HaShekel, only a half a shekel. So if today, let's say in America, you took the standard coinage as the dollar. The dollar is the dollar. So you, if I want to give a dollar, that wouldn't be accepted. I would have to give 50 cents, which is a half. Now, throughout the generations, the Machtzis HaShekel had to be at least the value that the Machtzis HaShekel was in the time of the desert, not less, but it was a half of the shekel of the time, whatever it was. Sometimes it was a little more, even than the value in the time of the Midra when the Jewish people gave it. And here there's a very famous question, and that is, what is the idea that the Torah insists that it has to be a Machtzis HaShekel? In other words, you cannot give a full shekel. Even if you want to, you couldn't give. We never find in the whole Torah that a donation is limited to only 50% of the shekel. And not only that, he says, Ha'asher lo yarba. If Mr. Rothschild wants to donate $1 million, to cover the offerings of the Beis HaMikdash, we say, sorry. Whoever heard of a Jewish institution turning to a wealthy person and say, sorry, sorry. You want to give $8? Good. You want to give $16? We don't accept it. And this was done every year. Ha'asher lo yarba. Even a wealthy person cannot give any more. In other words, you could have to give only machtzis. The question really becomes much stronger, considering the fact that in the Beis HaMikdash, it was always required that everything should be whole. Everything should be complete. Nothing should be blemished. For example, an offering that was brought had to be a whole offering. If it was a balmum, an animal that was a balmum, if it was blemished, it's not the animal's fault. But it couldn't be brought as a carbon. It couldn't be brought as an offering. If a kayin, if the priest serving the Beis HaMikdash was a balmum, had certain blemishes, also he had a different mission. He couldn't serve in the Beis HaMikdash, even though he could eat all of the offerings. But serving in the Beis HaMikdash, he could not do. Gemara says the clay sharis, the vessels that we use in the Beis HaMikdash, in order to sanctify that which is inside of them, they had to be malayan. They had to be full. And they had to be not flawed. If they were flawed, they had to be fixed in order to be used. So we constantly find the Rambam says about the Beis HaMikdash, kol chel of Lashem, all the fat should go to Hashem, meaning he says that all the offerings that go to Hashem should be tmimim and mufcharin. They should be whole and they should be the choicest. Here, we find the exact opposite notion. I want to give a whole shekel. Nope. Sorry. The only thing we accept is a machatzis shekel, a half a shekel, which the Torah itself says is a half. It's a half of the shekel. So the shekel was the whole coin. You can't give the whole coin. And it's interesting. What did they do with the machatzis shekel? They bought karbonas. They bought offerings. The offerings had to be all complete and wholesome. But the money that was used to purchase all of them had to be a machatzis shekel. Another very interesting thing is, when you look at the Torah here, it says, how much should you give machtes hashekel? And then in order to explain what that is, he says, esrim geira hashekel. 20 geira is the shekel, if something strange. We're not giving a shekel, we're giving a machtes hashekel. The Torah should have said, eser geira machtes hashekel. So you're going to say, yeah, it's not hard to do the math. If a shekel is 20 geira, geira was a certain coin, a smaller coin. There were many coins, like we have a penny, you have a dime, you have a nickel, you have a quarter, you have a dollar. These were all in silver. You had silver coins, you had gold coins, you had copper coins. But these were kesef. So a geira, 20 geira made up a shekel. So it's not hard to do the math. If 20 geira is a shekel, so half of that is 10 geira, so it's a machzis shekel. But why can't you say it directly? Instead of saying esrim, you say eser. Now you want to say the Torah wants to be meticulous and precise. On the contrary, eser is a shorter word than esrim. Eser is 10, Esrim is 20, Esrim is an extra two letters. So he could have said, it's Eser Geira. Eser Geira is a half a shekel, but he says, no, give a machtzis a shekel, but I want to tell you how much a whole shekel is. A whole shekel is Esrim Geira. So I want to tell you an explanation I heard for this. This explanation stayed with me. It's ingrained in my heart, in my soul, in my neshama. I heard this from the Lubavitcher Rebbe. It was Shabbos Parshas Vayakel, Parshas Shkolim, Shabbos Vayakel, Parshas Shkolim, Chafei Adar Aleph, Tov Shenun Beis, 1992. I grew up in Crown Heights, the section of Crown Heights in Brooklyn, New York. You've heard of Brooklyn before the mass migration, exodus for more space, especially during Corona. But I know some of you are here from the 1950s. Or whenever. So I don't mean Chas V'Shalom. I'm just talking about the immigrants. They called it the green ones, you know, the greenhorns. Who found out about deer and grass and trees and space, etc. And I had the privilege in the last years to be what's called one of the Chayzerim, one of the people who was who remembered the Rebbe's talks and transcribed them. The Lubavitcher Rebbe would talk on Shabbos and Yom Tov for a very long time, and they were very, very deep talks and shiurim and presentations, and of course there were no tape recorders. It was Shabbos and Yom Tov, so everything had to be memorized. Now you're talking about presentations that can go for 3 hours, 6 hours, 7 hours. It wasn't a 20-minute vertel, and so it was very intense, and if it was Yom Tov, it could be a few days, so it could be 10, 15 hours of ideas that had to be recorded. So there was a small group, they were called Chayzerim. Chazer means from the word chazara, right? Lachzar to chazar. The head of the group, his name was Rabbi Yoel Kahn, Olav HaShalom, Zecharin Olav Racha. And the last years I had the privilege of being that group, so we would remember and then transcribe it. So that Fabreng and Shabbos Vayakel, the Rebbe asked these questions that I just raised about the Machtzis HaShekel. Little did anybody know that this would be the last Fabrengen of the Rebbe ever. Because 2 days later, he went to the oil of his father-in-law, he would go there often to daven, and read a lot of the letters that he got. He would read there, stand there a whole day, fast, and stand there like twice a week. He would read thousands of letters there that he received. And he would daven there, the oil, it's in Queens, in Montefiore Cemetery. And over there, he suffered a stroke while he was standing there 2 days later, which was Monday, Chav Zayin Adar Aleph. But I didn't know this would be the last Fabrengen. And the Rebbe addressed these two questions. And then he gave an explanation, and that was the first talk of that Fabrengen. There were many talks during a Fabrengen, and in between they would sing. But this was the first talk. It was almost an hour. on Shabbos, Shabbos afternoon, Shabbos Vayakel. So it was extremely profound, intense, and a lot of different ideas and details that were culled together. I'm just culling, I'm extracting one point that the Rebbe made then in that talk that I still recall very vividly to answer these questions. And I'm just going to elaborate on it, explain it the way I understood it then and the way I understand it a little better today, so we can really relate to it, not just intellectually, but also viscerally, personally. The Rebbe said that the truth is, the question is really the answer. We're asking, why would the Torah tell people to donate machtzis ha-shekel when you're supposed to give a whole shekel? You said everything should be whole, complete. We don't want broken, or not broken, but incomplete things for the Beis HaMikdash. The truth is, and then we ask a second question, why did it say 20, not 10? So one question really answers the other question. The Torah wants a Jew should give a whole shekel, not a half a shekel. The Torah wants that a Jew should give a whole shekel. And that's why when the Torah says how much, it says Esrim Geira, not Eser Geira. 20 Geira, because really the mitzvah is to give a shekel. That's the mitzvah. The question then is, what do you mean? It says give a matzah shekel. It doesn't say give a shekel. It says here is where the Torah is conveying a life-changing approach on how you have to understand when you talk about I. You say the Torah wants me or you or us to give a half a shekel. What does that really mean? How do we define the individual? How do we define it's one of the big questions in psychology and philosophy and history. How do we define who is the I? Who is the one contributing the half a shekel? Or to put it simply, where do I begin? Where do I end? Where do I begin? Where do I end? And where do you begin? So common sense is, I am here, I'm standing here, you're sitting there, and there are boundaries, and these are important boundaries, right? I begin here, I end here, the other person is in a different place, they occupy their chair, their space, physically, and mentally, and spiritually, that's how it is. But here's the real question. A person, in his or her deepest place, are we lonely creatures or not? In other words, when you go down to the, hopefully everybody has some form of a social life, and connections, we're interconnected with each other, we have relationships with each other. But deep down, would you say that the truest way to define a person is lonely? Rabbi Soloveitchik has a book called The Lonely Man of Faith, Ish HaEmunah HaBoded. And he argues there that even though he has many friends and many acquaintances and many students, but deep down at his core, because he's a man of faith, there is a loneliness there. There's a sense of solitariness there. Vayivoser Yaakov levadoi. There's a place where a person is extremely alone. Boded, right? Echa yashva bodod. There's the concept of levad. The person is alone. And maybe in that deep place, that's the truest part of a person where we struggle with our own identity in ways that other people will never fully be able to get or comprehend, even if I share and even if I communicate and even if I express, but ultimately deep, deep down, there's that space that belongs exclusively to me, which I cannot share with anybody else simply because I am I and another person is another person. Or maybe it's not that way. Maybe in our deepest place, we're very, very connected. At first glance, there's certainly room to say that a person deep down, beyond all of the social connections and layers, there's a place of loneliness. And I think we all know this in our lives. As many friends as we have, and even very close friends, and as many relationships as we have, and even good relationships, I'm talking about authentic relationships, I'm not talking about, you know, fake relationships, but there are certain aspects of my existence that I know. Reb Nachman of Breslov talks about a pasuk in Tehillim. It says, some people say Shabbos morning, Ani yadati ki gadol Hashem. I know that Hashem is great. Ani yadati. He puts the emphasis, Ani yadati. There's something I know, and I feel and I experience, and nobody else can feel and experience. Not because I'm less smart or more sensitive or less sensitive, but simply because it's Ani yadati. It's the way I experience life. Everybody knows about their own lives. If you know about your own life, as much as I could communicate it and share it vulnerably and authentically, but there's that nekuda, there's that core experience that belongs to you, belongs to you alone, because it's you. And even if somebody else can have empathy and can really listen and may even shed tears with me or giggle with me and laugh with me, but nonetheless, there's the Rishus HaYachid, there's that private domain where you know your life story, you feel your pain, you feel your wounds, you feel your grandeur, you feel your mystery, you feel your ecstasy, you feel your depth, and you touch it in a way that I cannot expect another person to touch it, even if they want to be empathetic and loving, and they are, simply because I am I and you are you. But let's take it a step deeper. When we talk about the boundaries between people, it's a little more difficult than we like to describe it. For practical purposes, it makes a lot of sense to say, I am here, I begin here, I end here, and at some point you begin and you end, and then there's another person, you begin and you end. It's much more practical in terms of paying bills and taking care of a house and governing and taking care of your life. But if we really think about it truthfully, what about the oxygen? You say, I end right here. What about the oxygen that I need to inhale in order to survive? Where is that oxygen coming from? That oxygen is not inside of me. That oxygen I have to inhale from outside of me. And what about the water I need to drink in order to be able to live? And what about the food I need to eat in order to be able to live? There is not a single element in a person's existence that is completely self-contained. I must connect to that which is outside of me. So really, really, where do I begin and where do I end? Where do you begin and you end? So it ends right here? Well, it's not so simple, because if it ends right here, I can't really live. And that's why the Medrash says fantastically that really the planet is called a guf gadol. The whole planet is really one body. It's a large organism. Just like there's an individual organism, there's also a larger organism, and it's called a guf gadol, and that's what the ecosystem means. If you ever study the ecosystem, the brilliance of it is that there's nothing on our planet that is not a mashpia and not a mekabel. Every single nekuda, every single existence, every single creature on our planet, from the smallest, tiniest worm, the worm that we may dismiss, is making a contribution. I don't know if you know, but what makes the earth fertile for growth is the incessant work of the worms. Deep down in the ground, in the earth, they're not getting attention, they're not getting Nobel Prizes, they're not getting validation. Nobody knows about them, nobody looks at them, but they're fulfilling their God's mission. They're literally not stopping to crawl around and toiling and plowing the earth and making it fertile for vegetation. People for generations didn't know the purpose of lightning. They started to figure out how it happens, but what's the purpose of it? There's lightning somewhere on the planet, I think, every 8 seconds or so. Only recently did we realize it's indispensable to existence. And the reason is, we're not gonna do now a whole weather class, but it's fascinating to know, to see how Hashem created the world, because people often we're apathetic to it. There's nitrogen in the ear. Nitrogen is essential to produce what's called amino acids, which are the building blocks of every cell. No cell can exist without amino acid. The problem is there's no way for the amino acid to get into the earth, which is what we have a connection to. Lightning allows the nitrogen, because of the heat, to merge with the oxygen, and to merge with the droplets of rain. So now when the rain comes down into the earth, it's filled with nitrogen. So now all the plants and all the earth have amino acid. So now when I'm eating fruits or eating vegetables or eating animal meat that ate vegetation, my cells, our cells, can continue to reproduce, which is the essential building blocks of a person. So that's just the detail of lightning. You know, we look at wind storms, we look at winds, right? People don't realize that the sun acts, besides everything else, it also acts like a pump. And thus, it allows the water to be suctioning the water from the oceans and the seas, turning into a vapor, which then ascends and forms into clouds. But if there was no wind, what would happen? When the clouds would become heavy, the water would come right back to where it came out from, so the oceans would be refilled with water, and the entire earth would die,
because there's wind. So now the clouds are dispersed. So now when it rains, there's growth, there's vegetation, there's produce. And the earth is a fertile place. It's a living place. So, you know, sometimes you go out and say, it's so windy. Thank God. That's why we thank Hashem every day for Ruach, Sa'ara, Aysa Dvara. I just gave two, three tiny little examples of billions, trillions, trillions, endless examples. Every nekuda, every reptile, every mammal, every fish, every bird, every insect, every category of creation, doimim, tzemeh, chayim, and abba, the inanimate, the vegetation, the living. Of course, the human being is a mashpia and a makabel. We all give, we all contribute, we all receive. Now, it's interesting. Everyone knows this besides people. You know that. Everybody knows this. you'll ask any monkey. Ask any squirrel. They know. Ask a bee. Do you see how busy the bees are? Nobody pays them. Nobody wakes them up. They don't have their mothers waking up. Krishna davening. Tati's going to shul. Come on, wake up, Yankel. It's already 8:30, 9 o'clock. How long are you going to sleep? Till 4. The bees don't do that. Every bee in the world knows it has three purposes. Number one, survival. Number two, propagate or allow the queen to propagate. Number three, enhance the environment the way I need to enhance it. That's the purpose. Human beings can have a whole different conception in life. Why should I contribute to anything? I'm just a self-contained person. But the truth is, if you understand how the world works, everything is part of everything else. Everything gives and everything receives. Nothing is excluded from it. The reason human beings don't know it is because our job is to choose it, not to do it instinctively. The only one that reflects the Creator is the human being. The first thing about a Creator is that he's free, he has agency, so the human being also has agency, what we call bchira. So essentially I say, I end here, you begin here. I understand technically it's a good idea. You take this seat, I take this seat. I'm standing here, you're sitting there. But if we talk about it on a deeper level, on a spiritual level, on a psychological level, on a philosophical level, on a metaphysical level, where do I really begin and where do I really end? Every sound that comes out of my mouth creates a sound wave. It has an impact. Thoughts have impacts. When we make an observation of something in physics, we know today that when people observe light, the actual atomic, the structure of the light changes. They don't know if light was a particle or a wave because it has both qualities. And the way you observe it, when you observe it, it collapses into one model. So just observing something affects the other. And this is pure physics. It doesn't have to do with religion or spirituality. So there's no real point where you could say, this is me and that's it. And now begins you, and that's it. So the Medrash says, it says in Avos Reb Noson, our planet is a guf gadol. It's a large body. It's really we're connected to everything. Everything we're connected to. Everything is inside of us. And that's why we have that connection. We have that kinship. We have that relationship. And just like one organism has many different limbs, and every limb has a different purpose and function, and none of the two are supposed to do the same thing, my brain doesn't get angry with my heart and say, come on, just be like me, look like me. The brain is thankful for the heart that it's pumping the blood. And the heart is thankful to the brain that it's taking care of management, CEO, CFO. They're both thankful to the kidney for cleaning out what it has to clean out. They're thankful to the liver and to the spleen and to every limb doing its function. 70 trillion cells. I don't know if you know what 70 trillion means. 70 trillion cells in our body, each cell having its own unique functionality to keep the human being alive. It's haflu afel, it's beyond. And because of that, every limb does something else. The same is true with the planet. Every creature is like a limb of the body doing its unique thing. It's one cell. It's a small one, but it's significant. That's why the Baal Shem Tov once said that every leaf that rolls around is b'hashgacha. It's with divine providence. And not only that, he said, it's part of the plan that's essential to the whole story of creation. You would think it's a joke. It was a little leaf that fell off a tree and now it's rolling here and there. But if it's part of our planet, it's essential. It's part of a guf gadol. It's part of a guf. There's no cell in me that doesn't have its unique purpose and function. And it's not just true about our planet. On a more general level, it's true about the cosmos. It's true about the universe, not just about our planet. It's true about the universe that it's a guf gadol. And as a result of that, when we really think about it, we are part of a whole. We're part of an achdus. We're part of a larger whole. And that's why, even though it's true, there are parts of me that only I will understand. That's how it's supposed to be. There's parts of you only you will understand. There's aniya dati gadol Hashem. There's a vayivaser Yaakov levadoi. There's a place where Yaakov remains levadoi. There's a uniqueness to each person. And a uniqueness where aniya dati gadol Hashem. The way I experience life, the way I experience truth, the way I experience Hashem is different than every other person. The word yadati in Tehillim, aniya dati, is not just das, knowledge. Das in Tanakh means connection. Right? V'ha'adam yada es chava. Adam nu chava. And that's not talking about intellectual knowledge. It's talking about connection. Talking about marriage. They had children as a result. So aniya dati means I experience it in my own unique way. And you have to honor that and cherish it. Because that experience is unique to you and it's what I can bring to the world that nobody else could. It's your light or my light or somebody else's light that you bring based on aniya dati gadol Hashem. That's very true. But at the core of Yiddishkeit, and especially in the world of Kabbalah and the world of Chassidus and Machshava, loneliness is not at the core of reality. There is loneliness. There could be very acute loneliness, especially when a person doesn't feel that they have people they connect to on a deep level. But at the core, the truest, deepest essence of the human being is not that I'm a lonely man of faith, but that there is a unity, there is a connection. And the reason is because everything comes from one. When we say Shema Yisrael Hashem Elokeinu Hashem Echad, what does it mean? It means everything comes from Echad. So if everything comes from Echad, from oneness, so everything is rooted and anchored in Achdus Hapshuta. Achdus Hapshuta means undefined infinite unity, infinite wholeness. And because of that, essentially, when you peel away the layers and you trace everything back to its ultimate core, to the skeleton, to the bare bones, as we would say, to the quintessence, to the core, to the indivisible, what do we find? Indivisible oneness. That's then manifested in different creatures and different people and different pratim and different details. That's why in the morning before davening, there's the 13 methods of how Torah is interpreted, Rabbi Shmuel Eimer, before Haidu. So we have there, klal, uprat, prat, uklal, rings a bell? Klal, it's fine. your potter, remember, mitzvah sashri zaman grama, use it. But those who know what I'm talking about, maybe, so there's prat, uklal, klal, uprat, klal, prat, uklal, all these methods of how we interpret Torah. Really, klal is the collective, prat is the detail. Klal is bringing the detail back to the collective. So klal is from the word koilel, kol, everything. Prat is peret, which means one branch that trickles down from the klal. It's a manifestation of the klal, but it manifests it through a specific fashion. And then klal is when you could bring that prat and realign it with the klal. And that's the story of history. It starts with klal, achdus, Hashem echad, pre-creation. It comes into prat, where every person is an embodiment and a manifestation of that achdus, of that oneness, through their life, through your personality, your soul, your mind, your body, your life, your home, your family, and your unique existence. But essentially, every prat must and will come back to klal, because that's what it really is. It's a manifestation of that achdus, of Shema Yisrael, Hashem Elokeinu, Hashem Echad. With this, the Baal HaTanya, the Alter Rebbe, explains something fascinating. He asks the big question, when it says, V'ahavta l'reacha kamoicha, you should love your fellow like yourself. So the Ramban says, how can that be? How can that be? How can you say to me, a mitzvah, you should love someone else like you love yourself? I mean, come on. Be nice to somebody, be respectful, be kind, do chesed, yeah. But v'ahavta l'reacha kamoicha, how can you say that? And this is something that Mefarshim struggle with. It's a real mitzvah. So the Alter Rebbe, the Baal HaTanya in Tanya, in chapter 32, Lamed Beis, which is Perek Lev, the Lev is the heart, says something beautiful. He says, you're right. You're right when you're looking at the self from a more external point of view. But when you understand the real self. In other words, if I can get to the core of the I, then loving the other is actually very, very natural. In fact, it's not only a mitzvah, it's actually a prediction. Vahafta in Hebrew means two things. It means you shall love, and it also means you will love. Vahafta l'recha kamoich is not just a commandment, it's also a prediction. When you're really going to start loving yourself, your real self, you're going to love the other like yourself. You know why? So this is what he says. Vahafta l'recha kamoich, we learn it as a, you should love somebody else like yourself. It's really saying something else. Vahafta l'recha, you're going to love l'recha kamoicha, just like you love yourself, because you're one. There is a self that is isolated, but there's a larger self. The larger self is the one that's rooted in achdus, in oneness, in infinity that includes everything. And that's why if you look in the pasuk, Kedoshim Perek Yites, your first verse, v'ahavta l'recha kamoicha, Ani Hashem. Where does Ani Hashem come in there? You will love your friend like yourself. Ani Hashem, I am Hashem. Okay, thank you Hashem. Thank you for introducing yourself. The commentators struggle with this. Does it mean I'm going to give schar? What's Ani Hashem? But now we understand Ani Hashem is actually explaining the pasuk. Vahafta, you will love l'recha kamoicha like you because Ani Hashem. Since Ani Hashem and all of you are manifestations of Hashem, so re'acha is kamoicha. The other person is actually kamoicha. So I have to ask myself, what part of me do I love? Is it my suit that I love? Right? Maybe. I love me. I love my suit. Maybe I like my tie. It's a nice suit and a nice tie. My wife chose. Right? I may love my glasses. Somebody may love their watch, may love their jewelry, may love other parts. I may love certain parts of my, whatever it is. That is, it's good to appreciate all these things. But do I have real self-love? Real self-love means, do you really have a relationship with your truest self? And I would venture to say that sometimes in life, when I don't have that real self-love, I need other things to love about me to be able to make believe that I am lovable. So very often, I spend so much time loving my external things that maybe will get certain validation from others as a compensation for the absence of real self-appreciation. Real self-love means I can truly not only respect, but cherish and embrace and turn my innermost soul, which is a chelik elekami mal mamish, which is literally a derivative of divine consciousness, truly cherish it, really love it, really embrace it. So when we say, somebody asked me once, what's the source for self-love in Judaism? Because people talk about self-love. We never heard about that. We always heard, v'ahavta l'recha kamoicha. I said, read the pasuk. V'ahavta l'recha kamoicha. First of all, if you hate yourself, how exactly do you have a reference point? Right? If I'm supposed to love somebody like I love myself, so if I hate myself, what am I going to do? I may have that. That's the barometer of how I relate to other people. But it's really much deeper than that. Real self-love doesn't mean I love my watch or my tie or even what I look like today, and I may not look like that tomorrow. Real self-love is loving my body, yeah, but what is my body? My body is a channel for my soul. The guf is a channel. The guf is a Beis Hamikdash for the Shechina. So real Avos Yisrael and self-love are not a contradiction. When you really love the true self, it instinctively and deeply extends to the other. That's what the Alter Rebbe says in Tanya, the Balatanya. If you look in the Susha, Tanya Perek Lamed Beis, B'shegam Shekulon Masimos. All the souls are equal. Va'av echad l'kulana. There's one father for all. V'lachei nikru kol yisrael achim mamish mitzat shodesh nafshim b'shem echad. Rak she'agufim echalak. That's why the Jewish people are called brothers. So you think brothers is an exaggeration? Yeah, we're brothers, we're sisters. He says, no, it's mamish. What's the idea of siblings? What's siblings? Siblings means that they're rooted in one source. They're manifestations of one mother and one father. Mitzat shodesh nafshim b'shem echad. The shayrish, the root of every soul, like a tree, is in oneness. Hashem Echad. You can't turn Hashem into 15 billion pieces. God is not divided into 15 billion pieces. It's Hashem Echad. And each soul is a derivative of that. Rak shahagufim echolakim. It's just each soul was manifested in a unique guf, in a unique body, to reveal the oneness within the details. V'lachena oisim gufam ikar v'nafsham tfeila i'efshalias ahva v'ahva amitiz b'neim ela atluya b'dova levada. And that's why he says something very powerful. If I don't have a relationship with my soul, I can't really experience authentic love. I can only experience love that is tluya bedavra, which means it has ulterior motives. That can work. I make a partnership with somebody, right? You're an investor in my company. I'm an investor. You make money. I make money. It makes sense. These are friendships that make sense because I gain something from you. You gain something from me, which is fine. But I still did not go out of the place of ego. It's just a relationship with another person helps me. To go out of a place of ego, this you need to learn about your soul. Because the soul doesn't exist in a place of ego. It's egoless. It doesn't need ego. It doesn't need ego to exist. On the contrary, it shuns the ego. Ego keeps it isolated, right? Like we said, ego is easing God out, easing godliness out, easing goodness out, easing greatness out. I'm just making up all these acronyms on the spot. If you know any other good G, I'm not going to say easing Google out, even though that's a good idea sometimes in life, but that's a separate class, separate discussion. Easing greatness out, meaning if I'm not in touch with my own greatness, then of course I need my ego and I need to protect it and I need your validation and I need to build it up and I need to do whatever I need in order for my ego to feel good, but my soul is starving. What the soul needs more than anything else is the soul needs the absence of ego. The soul is looking for transcendence. The soul is looking to be a channel for what it really is. What is it really? It's a manifestation of Hashem Echad, of oneness. That's the bliss of the soul. So over there, achdus, unity, love is organic. It's essential. It's intrinsic. And therefore, as a result of that, when I can cut through my external layers and reach a deeper place of the self, according to this explanation in Tanya, which is a fundamental idea in Hasidus in general, I don't touch loneliness. I touch love. I touch attachment. I touch connection. On the contrary, if I'm stuck and confined in my ego, then I'm in solitary confinement. There's a lack of trust. There's a lack of connection. In the place of the soul, naturally, I want to embrace. I want to hug. I want to dance and celebrate life with the other. The Chiddush HaRim, the first Gei Rebbe, says something beautiful. He says that the Gemara says in Maseches Shabbos, page 31, that a non-Jew came to Hillel. Remember this story. And he said, teach me the whole Torah while I'm standing on one leg. So Hillel said, yeah, 6 words. I'll give you a crash course in Judaism, 6 words. What you dislike to be done to you, don't do to anybody else. That's the whole Torah. Everything else is commentary. Now go study the commentary. Question. Why did Hillel have to use 6 words when he could have used 3 words? Which words should have he used? Number 2 is in Hebrew. Instead, he used words in Aramaic. Number 3 is God's choice of words. What do you have to make up your new sentence? Is Hashem's phrase. It's from a pasuk. It's in Chumash, Parshas Kedoshim. Why do you have to make up it's a nice phrase. What you dislike to be done to you, don't do it to anybody else. They call it the golden rule. They attribute it to somebody else, but it comes from Hillel. You don't know what I'm talking about? Okay, it's fine. Hillel lived before him, 100 years before him, 150 years before. They attribute it to another Jew, but I'll tell you a cute story. It just came into my head. My brother was talking to a group of cardinals. They wanted to learn about Jewish approach to morality and ethics, all these types of things, and family life and marriage. So he told me after a long conversation, it became very warm and very friendly. They really opened up. These are cardinals from the Catholic Church. Finally, in the sense of openness, they turn to him and they throw out that question. They say, Rabbi Jacobson, at the end of the day, tell us the truth. Who's Messiah? Now, in here he knew this is what's called real. What is he going to do? Right? He told me God gave him an insight. He looked at them. He said, one Jew or another. They all laughed and all is well that ends well. They loved it. So, but this comes from the Jew Hillel, not from another Jew. Hillel could have used the words of the Torah. He says, this fellow, when he came to Hillel, he wasn't Jewish yet. He wasn't Jewish. He was a non-Jew. So to tell him, v'ahavta l'recha kamaycha, he wouldn't be able to chop it. What are you talking about? Mada Allah sani l'chavrach lo'y savid, that's a golden rule for all civilization. What you dislike to be done to you, don't do to you. You want your children to be safe, make sure other people's children are safe. You don't want to be robbed, don't rob from someone else. That's the basis of civilization. Without that, there's no civilization. V'ahavta l'recha kamecha already requires a much more sensitive attunement to the cosmic nature of oneness, to this unique element of Hashem Echad. For this, he still had to go through training and spiritual evolution and so forth. They say the Zviller Rebbe, was Reb Shlomka Zviller. He had a son. Zvil is a city in Ukraine. He had a son, Reb David Moshe, I think was his name. Goldman, the family was Goldman. They lived in Zvil, Ukraine, and he was exiled to the Gulag, to Stalin's Gulag, Siberia, for a few years. The Zviller Rebbe, Reb Shlomka Zviller's son. And he was liberated, he was in a Siberia. I don't have to tell you about the conditions in Siberia, but most people didn't survive. Millions and millions died in Stalin's gulags in Russia. After a few years in the gulag, he was summoned by the nachalnik, by the warden, and he told him that he can go free today, but he has to sign. It was Shabbos. So the Zviller Rebbe tells this fellow, I can't sign on Shabbos. I have to sign tonight or tomorrow. So he said, listen, you're playing with fire here. This is the Soviet Union. Don't bring in your religion. If you want to sign now, fine. If you don't sign now, I don't know if you'll get out of here. He said, I'm sorry. I understand. Thank you. But I'm not going to violate Shabbos. Now, near him, there was another Jew, a communist, a Jewish communist who was secular. He was also in Siberia. And he was standing there because he was also supposed to go free. So this man now turned to him and said, sign. And he was a secular Jew. But because he just saw the sacrifice, the Mesiras Nefesh of the Zviller Rebbe, he couldn't get himself to sign. So he told this person, he said, sorry, it's Shabbos, Subota. Have you read the book Subota? I can't sign. About 20 years in Siberia. Who was it? I can't sign. So the guy said, what's your problem? He says, Shabbos, it's our holy day. I'm not signing. So he says again, if you don't sign, I don't know if you're going to get out of here. He says, I'm not signing till after Shabbos. So the Zviller Rebbe turns to the prison warden and says, I'm going to sign for him. He says, you mishuga? He says, I'll sign for him. He's an older man, he's weak. And for him to stay here another day is life-threatening. And bikuach nefesh, to save a life, overrides all the mitzvahs, including Shabbos. I don't feel that way about myself. I could stay here. I don't have a right to violate Shabbos. So I'm going to sign for him. The prison warden saw this. He says, wow, you know what? I'm going to sign for both of you. Tzeischem l'shalom, get out of here. Yeah. So the Chiddush Arim says, he can understand, Mada lachsani l'chavrech l'isavet, v'havta l'recha kamoicha, was extremely, extremely profound. So when a person truly relates to the real self, the most wholesome core self, then when I look at the other, I see the divinity in me, I see the divinity in you. Our souls are one. They're one. The bodies are manifestations of the souls, but the souls are really one. So in the most natural, intrinsic core space, there's not just a connectivity, but there's actually an absolute oneness that reflects Hashem Echad. Even though it's different people. It's like limbs of one body. It says in the Gemara in Yerushalmi, Masechet Yoma, like limbs of one body. Limbs of one body don't do the same thing. They don't have the same personality. My heart and my brain don't have the same personality. That's why we have issues between what we understand and what we feel. But they're not supposed to have. Thank God my heart doesn't always agree with my brain. Thank God my brain doesn't always agree with my heart. They have to work things out. But as a result of that, we understand, but it's one. Nobody says, cut my heart out. I don't have a relationship with them. Cut it out. It's ridiculous. Chas v'shalom. We're talking about oneness. So it's like limbs of one body. It's like diverse colors of one painting. Different colors, but one portrait, one painting. Bricks of one home and notes of one composition. A composition, a ballad, a song can't be one note. It has diverse notes. And therefore, the Baal Shem Tov used to teach that if somebody feels very, very spiritual, perhaps, but I'm still feeling alone, what they call in Yiddish, elent, I'm feeling alone deep down, it means that I'm not completely rooted in my soul. I'm still stuck in a bubble that's surrounding my soul. And that bubble is creating a blockage. I did not touch the space of the soul itself. When I'm truly, truly in a place of neshama, I am full, naturally, organically, instantaneously. A person is then filled with brotherhood, with sisterhood, with ava, with achva, with love, with shalom v'reis. I want to connect to another person. I don't have to subdue myself and force myself. That's why it says in Bereishis, the beginning of the Torah, that everything Hashem saw was good. He saw what He made and it was very good. And then finally it says one thing that's not good. What's the first thing the Torah says that's not good? After everything that's good. Loi toiv, you remember? Loi toiv ayos ha'adam levadoi. It's not good for Adam to be levadai, to be alone. It's not just a mitzvah. It's not good, and therefore we're going to get chava and you're going to get married. It's more than a mitzvah. It's a description of reality. The state of levadai means that I'm disconnected from the goodness of life, from the goodness of creation. One of the deepest wounds of a person is when I go into emotional isolation, psychological solitariness, and I'm afraid to come out of my hiding place. I'm afraid to come out of my closet. Maybe I'll peek out, but I'm going to go right back in. And the truth is, and we have to understand this, this is not about blame ever or judgment, but a person needs to understand one of the wounds, one of the coping mechanisms that some of us, and I would say quite a few of us, I don't mean in this room, but in society, develop is a sense of safety in isolation. And there could be many reasons for it. One of, I think, the very prevalent reasons for it, at least one of them is, if I have an open heart, and I'm really a very loving person, and I want to give love and I want to be loved, and maybe as a little child, I gave out those vibes of love, but I couldn't receive them back, for whatever reason. And it's painful. It's painful. If a child searching for connection, searching for that unconditional love, can't receive it for whatever reason, and it may not even be malicious. It may be just apathy, ignorance, neglect. Maybe parents themselves so stressed out in their own loneliness and isolation, they're trying to survive. Their hearts, they can't afford for their hearts to be open. They have to close their hearts. But now this child, to continue to live with an open heart means that every day I'm going to feel again my loneliness. Every day I'm going to feel pain. How many times can I have a dagger, chas v'shalom, in my chest? I can't. So at some point, maybe at 3, maybe at 4, maybe at 6, maybe at 8, I say to myself, I don't need love. I don't need connection. I don't need attachment. I don't want to say I need it. It's who I am and I'm not getting it. Maybe I say I don't need it. Maybe I say even worse, I deserve not to get it. These are different voices that my brain develops in order to make sense out of my life and not to sacrifice the attachments that I do have because the people around me are giving me food and safety and a place to sleep, etc. And now suddenly I'm 20 years old, 30 years old, 40 years old, 50 years old, or whatever age the person is, and I turn it into a philosophy. It becomes a philosophy. I'm just a person who doesn't connect. I don't know how to really connect with my spouse. I don't know how to really connect with my children. I'm an intellectual. I like shiurim that are intellectual because I'm not emotional. Somebody once told me, our family is not the emotional type. We don't hug, we don't kiss, we don't embrace, we don't say I love you. We're the intellectual type. Stop calling horrible survival mechanisms a philosophy. It's not a philosophy. We're wounded. Many of us have been wounded. Our people have been through Shiva Medure Gehenim. Without judgment, with compassion, with empathy, we could appreciate the fact that there is so much pain that causes a person to say, I don't need connection. I don't even know how to connect. And if I come out again, will I get another dagger in my heart? I'm not going to come out again from my closet. Now remember, sometimes you have chevra guys, let's say boys in yeshiva, where it's all, you know, you use your brain a lot and you don't have to connect on that level. So in yeshiva, they're top level. And then they get married. Right? And their wife is not interested in intellectual gymnastics, which are holy. They're holy. But the wife wants that relationship and she starts asking about his emotions and she starts poking those places that he closed up 20 years ago. So what happens? I'm talking about unconsciously. He's a good guy. She becomes his enemy because she's making him feel horrible. horrible. And it's very hard for him to look in the mirror and even know what happened. He may not even know what happened. So he's the most innocent person, trying to do the right thing, and yet trying to survive. He says, oh, my wife is this, my wife is this, my wife is that. Or the other way around, my husband is this, my husband is that. It takes so much courage and humility to be able to ask myself, maybe what I really need more than anything else is real attachment, real connection. I don't know if the human being has been yet created who doesn't need real attachment, who doesn't need real connection. Of course, there are people who are bookworms. There are people who are social butterflies. We know that. There are people who love spending nights with other people, right? If you had a choice, you can spend the night in your house, alone, on a couch, without anybody in sight, or you can go out to a simcha. Some people, well, you'll make your choice. There are different natures of people. Some people come alive with people, and some people, do me a favor, you come back from a bar mitzvah, and 3 weeks you have to recover from the energy. Salt baths, therapy, I don't know, Pilates, whatever it is, but I'm recovering from the simcha, too much energy for me. And other people come to life. Of course, there are different natures of people. But when the Torah says, Loi toi ve'yoysa adam levadai, God doesn't say, besides the people who live in this area, they could be levadai. It's the true nature of existence, that in the deepest place, we need connection. You know why? Because we are connected. It's not we need connection because we're spoiled, selfish people who want attention. No. Maybe if I did not get that type of real connection, then I want attention because I need to get some form of connection. So if a child couldn't get love, he starts looking for validation. So maybe he becomes unbelievably successful in yeshiva and school. And that way everyone praises this child and this child feels that they're valued. But this value is coming because they did not get real value based on who they are. It's based on performance. This becomes very painful. And this is something one needs to be aware of. So sometimes I stay in my closet because it's very dangerous for me to come out. Sometimes we peek out. We peek out. Can I come out? Come out. And then somebody says the right comment and you know, not time. And you go back and I go back into my closet for another decade. If I'm dealing with this, and many are, I need to respect this, but I cannot turn my need for isolation into the entire story. It's my animal consciousness trying to survive. And maybe survival for me means at the moment I can't really connect. And I have to work that through. But I should never doubt that if I go into my nefesh elikis, my divine consciousness, there is so much love there. There is so much connection. I'm going to tell you, it just came into me and I was not planning to say this, but somebody shared this with me recently. And I have to say, it's one of the most moving things I heard from somebody. Talk about, you want to know what a soul is, what nobility means. It's hard to share this story because it's a very painful story. This is a person, a fellow, a man, who as a child has went through Gehenim after Gehenim after Gehenim by people he trusted most, in the most horrific ways, meaning the abuse literally affected the core of his soul, because it was the intimate, inappropriate abuse in the most intimate places of a person. I don't have to get graphic here, you'll understand. What's worse is, there was no story that he can identify, meaning externally, everything was perfect, everything was fine, the people were normal, the people were loving, so it's something that he didn't even know. So in here, not only are you isolated, not only are you completely, he was disassociated emotionally, but he also blamed himself for everything. So not only am I in pain, and not only am I so much in pain that I don't even know I'm in pain, I'm so much in fear I don't even know I'm in fear because he became disconnected from his emotions, but the only one to blame is me. There was no other story. So the level of self-shame and self-loathing, the coping mechanisms this poor guy developed were beyond description, simply to survive. He survived, and he survived well, but completely disconnected from himself, from his body, from his feelings, from his emotions, from his selfhood, from identity, no dignity, nothing. Hashem made him a very talented person, so he made a good living, makes a good living, does well, but on an internal level, he was mamash like a dead man walking. Decades down the line, he began a healing journey. He discovered a lot of things. Very, very courageous person. And he really went into the darkness. And he went on a very, very deep journey of healing. He shared something with me, unbelievable. He said after one of his healing journeys, that was a very, very deep experience, he started to think about two people who hurt him so badly. And when I say hurt him, it was not small things. It was very serious things. And he started to feel, listen to this, so upset with them, which is part of healing, you know. There's grief, there's feeling, all the pain. But then he said after this journey, he felt something else. He felt that, you know what, the real avla that was done to him, the real crime that was done to him, the real crime was done to him is that it took away from him his ability to love others. He never realized how much love he has in his heart. It even took away his ability for him to love these people in his family who did it to him. He realized he has so much love to them. But because of all the pain they caused him, he couldn't have that love. And that's what he was grieving. He was grieving the love that was the gift of love that was taken from him. I said, wow, look what a soul you have. Look what a neshama you had. If you wouldn't have had a nefesh alekis, I promise you, if somebody takes a machine and bangs it with a hammer over and over and over, take your computer, take your car, take any machine, take your phone and bang it and break it and break it, at some point there's nothing left. It's a dead machine, right? Nothing left. What happened to you that after everything, you're grieving the love that you couldn't express all your life? Do you see that your soul is a piece of Hashem and nobody can abuse Hashem? So even while all of this was happening, your neshama was right there present, experiencing everything, but from a place of infinity. And today when your soul is talking, because the layers have been removed, your soul is saying, wow, I am so hurt that my gift of love was compromised. And this was as genuine as you could get. This was no show to me. This was said with a lot of tears and sobbing. But it shows you the power of a soul. A soul could never be destroyed, stifled, repressed, crushed. The person was not aware of their soul. They had blockage after blockage after blockage after blockage. They couldn't feel loy toiva yisadam levadai. For them, the only safety they had was to be levadai. They had to be levadai from themselves. They couldn't even have a relationship with themselves. Once you start feeling emotions, who knows what's going to come up? Once you start feeling your body, who knows what's going to come up? Once you start being embodied and connected, you don't even know what's going to happen. So for his brain, especially his amygdala, he had to go into that place in order to be alive. That was the levadai. But ultimately, the truth is that in that all, there is a majestic divine soul that remains so connected, even connected as hard as it is with those people. And he forgave them. He forgave them. He forgave them genuinely. They didn't ask for forgiveness, but he forgave them. Now, I'm going to make this disclaimer because some people hearing this will say, oh, really? I should forgive? I'm not telling you to forgive. I can't tell somebody else what to do. But I'm saying that this person became so spiritually and emotionally healthy and robust that he realized, he told this to me, that not forgiving would have been a crime against himself. Why? I can't forgive you really means what? You still control my life. You make me miserable, you make me bitter, and therefore I'm not going to forgive you. My not forgiving you is my last chance for revenge. It's my last chance. I'm not forgiving you, Rasha Marusha. And I get it. I completely empathize and understand. But realize, you still have so much power over me. Now, this is not something I can do with a snap of a finger. I'm not going to sit in this room and say, everybody just forgive. Because we're not talking about fictional forgiveness. We're talking about an authentic transformation. What I am saying is, that when you continue to work on yourself, when we continue to work on ourselves, with a lot of compassion, and a lot of support, and a lot of love, and a lot of honesty and authenticity, the soul is capable, at least very often, maybe not always, very often to reach a space where you really don't have control over my life. Where I could say, you know what, you did not ruin my life. That's what redemption means. You did not ruin my life. What do you mean you did not ruin my life? You did! Once your soul is really, really prevailing in your life, you did not ruin that. You couldn't. Like nobody ruined God. Nobody ruined Hashem's life. Nobody turned Hashem into a incompetent, insecure, where God wakes up in the morning, he says, I'm not sure, do I exist? Don't I exist? Ani Hashem lo shanisi v'atem b'nei Yaakov lo chilisim. The prophet Malachi, the last prophecy, says, I have not been destroyed, I have not changed, you too cannot be destroyed. And that's also true individually about every single neshama. So therefore, when I'm in the place of my soul, I will always know the sign for it is authenticity, vulnerability, and attachment. Authenticity means the soul will never lie. Vulnerability means the soul will not be afraid to be honest, to be vulnerable, to be who I really am. I'm not going to play other people in order to get somebody's approval. And attachment means the soul is connected. The soul wants to connect. The soul is in a space of love. Now, I may be triggered and I'm not ready to be authentic. I'm not ready to be vulnerable. I'm not ready to be attached. And I have to understand that those things came up and I have to honor it. And I have to work with it. But I should not doubt that there's a deeper self that's waiting for full emancipation where there is going to be unbelievable, powerful connection and love. No problem. Very good. It's not me, it's my phone. I love that. Imagine we could say that always. It's not me, it's my phone. It's not me, it's my Nefesh HaBahamas. Okay? It's true for everybody. But we have to be careful because some people have been through so much. And when people start telling them, you know, just forgive, forgive, it's easy for me to say to somebody else, forgive. But it's such a sensitive process that people really have to work through in themselves. Because you want it to be genuine. You don't want it to be, I forgave, but really tomorrow I know that I did not forgive. And the moment I see you, right, at my brother Simcha, I'm like, I'm out of here, right? I'm out of here, I'm out of here. Which makes sense. So we just have to be very honest. And you know, there are ups and downs. There are levels of forgiveness too. And also, you don't want forgiveness should come at the expense of people honoring their experience. You understand? If forgiveness means I don't honor your experience, I just want our family to look perfect, what I'm really doing is I'm re-abusing the person. That's not fair. That's not fair. Yeah? Great question. This person told me that the hardest person to forgive was himself. He forgave everybody else. He thought that was the biggest hurdle. And then when it came time to forgive himself, he told me he was sobbing for hours, saying to himself, I did not do it. I did not do it. He has deceived, he has imagined that he was guilty for everything. And that was more painful than anything. In other words, the self-shame was so deep that to let go of that was the hardest thing in the world. People don't realize that. Forgiving the other may be very hard, but forgiving the self, in a way, is so excruciatingly difficult. Because that's my entire narrative. And sometimes so many things I do, I think I'm doing out of responsibility because I'm blaming myself. Which means everything I'm doing is really feeding into my coping mechanism. And that's why we have it so many times, we feel it so hard to serve Hashem with simcha. We say, why can't I serve Hashem with joy? Why can't I daven with joy? Why can't I prepare for Shabbos with joy? Why can't I have Chanukah with joy? Why do I always feel that sense of, ugh? And I have to force myself to smile, and I go to a shir, and the shir says, you have to be besimcha, and I make believe I'm besimcha for 6 minutes until I see that the groceries have not been put away. And those are the smaller stuff. And I'm going to say something, and it's, I think, very, very authentic and very, very deep. And if it doesn't relate to you, scratch it from the record. It's fine. And that is because very often, my entire religious life may be a compensation for the inner lack of self-forgiveness. So I'm davening and I'm learning and I'm doing mitzvahs, really, in order to find a way of saying, you know what, I'm not such a bad person after all. In other words, my entire Avodas Hashem is being controlled by trauma. You with me? Okay, I'm not the only Meshuggana. Baruch Hashem. I didn't think so for whatever reason. I had a hunch that I wasn't. Yeah, yeah, overperforms validation, or it's manifested in so many ways. It's not even validation from somebody else. Nobody will even know. I may even say to myself, you know, I don't do this for anybody else. I do this only for Hashem. But my relationship with Hashem is so eclipsed. It's so tarnished. It's so contaminated. And I blame Hashem. And yeah, ultimately he's, you know, to blame for everything. But really, I have to look into myself, you know. Does God really want you to blame? Am I blaming myself? And I don't know that, so I blame Hashem. Because the soul doesn't have answers to all the questions. But the soul is so happy in who it is because it's a manifestation of divine oneness. We say every day in davening, it's the best line. Oiz v'chedva b'mkaymai. In Hashem's space, there's confidence and there's joy. How do I know that I'm in the space of my soul? There's confidence and there's joy. Oiz v'chedva b'mkaymai. There's confidence. The soul doesn't doubt itself. It knows who it is. It has no questions who it is. It's a chelik alekam mimal. It doesn't doubt itself. V'chedva, and it's in a place of joy and bliss because it's a manifestation of Hashem. Now you say, Rabbi Weibel, who are you talking about? Confidence, bliss, which world are you living in? I know. We operate very often with so many blockages and we don't always have the tools of even beginning to explore this process. And it all begins with awareness. But the truth is, when a person has the courage to do real Avodas Hashem, what's real Avodas Hashem? Peeling away these layers and going into this place of authenticity and vulnerability, we reach a place of a real relationship. And then we're not doing things to be yaitze, to cover up on my self-shame. There's actually full presence. What does it mean to daven with full presence? To daven with full presence doesn't mean that every thought that comes into me, I get angry and I push away. That's not called full presence. Full presence means I reach a place of such deep acceptance and I open myself up to my soul's relationship, which is always connected. It's a channel for God, and it's literally Hashem's light in this world. And I'm in that place. There is presence. There's nothing else but presence. Presence, I would say, is one of the hardest things in life. Full presence. You're in a conversation with your partner, with your spouse, with your soulmate, with your child. Full presence. Full presence doesn't mean I'm not going to Costco. I'm not watching a Rabbi YY clip. I'm not watching another piece of news. Obviously, even my clips can take away from your presence. Unless I'm talking about presence, then you can watch it. Full presence is emotional. It's emotional. It's like, this relationship is life. How can I do that? You know how many things I have to do? I have so many things to do. What, I have nothing better to do than to play Monopoly with my kid, really? There's nothing better to do. Do you know what's happening in Israel? As though if I stop playing Monopoly with them, I'm going to be saving Israel. Because I'm a worried, anxious Yiddish tata or mama. But full presence means actually I'm in a relationship with Hashem. The Baal Shem Tov said Hashem recreates the world every single moment. So that means the only moment that matters is right now. In other words, all of life is happening right now. So to be present means I'm present to the miracle of life right at this moment, and I'm in a place of gratitude. Gratitude. Gratitude for this moment that I am channeling. I am a channel of that energy. And it's not I am with a sense of ego. It's like an organic oneness with the source. If you have been there, you know what I'm talking about. If you haven't been there, you have what to look forward to. All of us, I mean, very, you know, tzaddik is always in that place. You know, many of us, even if we understand what we're talking about, we can go in, we go out, because we have so many different blockages. That's what Avodas Hashem is. That's why we reconnect every day. It's not, I connect once, you know, you water a plant and it lives. You put an oil and the candle burns. I have to replenish it. So in this sense, when this person is in that space, there is a full sense of presence. Now here we come to one more step. And this is how Judaism understands marriage. Of course it's easier, Father. Some people, now this doesn't have to do with being a social butterfly. Some people are social butterflies. That's not what we're talking about. Some people go over at a simcha to every person that they have what to say. You know those people? They have what to say. They know how to, I don't know how they do it. They find something to say. To connect. And it's a gewaldic thing, and they have seminars how to do it, networking and all that. They find how to connect. But I'm not talking about that. I'm not talking about anything that's exploitive or even, not that they're manipulative or exploitive, but I'm not talking about, you know, a shtick or a game or a talent that you skill. We're talking about an essential place. Sometimes there are people that are very, very private people, but they know how to connect. You know, when you connect, it's real connection. Doesn't mean I'm loud and I have what to say to everybody and I love crowds. Not necessarily. Maybe a very, very intimate and private person, but there's what's called exclusivity and intimacy. When you're having a conversation with somebody, is there exclusivity and intimacy? Sometimes some people are just not capable of that. And within 2 minutes, they start talking about somebody else. We're talking about heart-to-heart things. Why are we talking about somebody else? Because right away the whole world comes in. It's a good distraction. Exclusivity and intimacy means connection, full presence. And full presence is a very spiritual experience because it basically means that my soul is relaxed. It accepts itself. Why is my soul relaxed? B'smashuga, the house is this. Pesach is coming. Purim is coming. It's two bishvat. It's almost like Bayim is going to be the Shoshana. What about summer plan? B'smashuga, who gave you a right to relax, B'chlal? And we're in Golos. Why are you sitting on a couch? Why are you a couch potato? Why are you sitting on a couch? There's somebody I know told me that every time they sit down on a couch with a cup of coffee, there's a voice inside of them that says, who gave you this right to be so narcissistic? Imagine. I wonder, where did that voice come from? Matan Torah, Bris Ben Apsarim, where did it come from? Not everybody here knows what I'm talking about, and you're lucky, right? You, like me, we're the babies of the family, so we're good. It's a peshet abyssal. But some people know what I'm talking about. It's like, chas v'shalom, you're going to be accused of laziness. So a lot of my avoid is all based on these messages, and it's very deep, it's not conscious. So how can I really be besimcha? So it's like a force simcha. Get ready for Purim with force. Get ready for Pesach with force. Get ready. And the truth is, it's a lot of work. But the more we could connect with that place that does not blame itself, because it's really not guilty, it's a whole different type of relationship. I don't need to do it. I get to do it. I don't have to do it. I have an opportunity to do it. So now let's see how this translates into marriage, because that's really where these two different approaches play themselves out in the most powerful way. There's really two ways of looking at marriage. One way of looking at marriage is it's two separate people who came together. They decided to build a dream together. It may work out. Hopefully it's going to work out. And if chas v'shalom, it doesn't work out. That's one way of looking at it. The Jewish way of looking at it is much deeper. Adam and Chava were created as one being. Then they were separated into two. So the Ramban says, why didn't you just create two separate people? With all other animals, take horses, Hashem made male and female. And they propagate. Why with the human being? You're anyway separating them. So why are Adam and Chava created as one and then you go through a whole surgical decoupling? It says in Gemara, Rashi brings, they would do partsufim like Siamese twins, and now they have to be separated, and agan samaisen, you have to put Adam to sleep, and he still didn't wake up. A shloftnach. That's the Kotzke Rebbe. The Kotzke Rebbe said that. A shloftnach, he's still sleeping. It's not my own vart. Mm-hmm. So but this is the whole idea. If marriage, Hashem would have separated Adam and Chava, then essentially what's marriage? Two separate people joining, and hopefully that will work out. Marriage in Judaism is much deeper. It says in Zohar that it's shnei plage gufa. It's two halves of one body coming back together. It's two halves of one soul. In other words, the chuppah, the marriage, is not a union, it's a reunion. There's a discourse of the Baal HaTanya, the Alter Rebbe. He says, why is a wedding a cause for celebration? Why? And he answers, he says something very powerful. He says, these two souls were inseparably best friends before birth. And then the souls came down into different families, into different bodies. And we meet different people during our life. But it's not that friend. It's not that best friend. So when they get married, it's a reunion of those two friends, he says, who haven't seen each other for so many years, and they reconnect. That's Simchas Chasam V'Kala. Why is this relevant? It's relevant because it means that a true marriage from the Yiddishkeit perspective is not two separate people who are now coming together and let's make it work. But rather there's an essential organic oneness. Adam and Chava are one. Then they're separated. When they come back together, they're B'Tselem Elokim. They're reflecting Hashem, who's one. So the feminine and masculine energy really complete that wholeness. And the ramifications of that can be very, very profound. Because what it means is marriage suppressing my natural identity for the sake of a relationship. In other words, I'm surrendering me for the sake of you. You're surrendering you for the sake of him or for the sake of her. Is that what's happening? No, on the contrary. Marriage really means that I'm allowing myself to connect with my own wholeness, with my own fullness. By connecting to the other, by marrying the other, we become B'Tselem Elokim, like Adam and Chava when they're one. In other words, reflecting the oneness of Hashem. And it doesn't mean they have the same personalities. Doesn't mean they always agree. It's just like the limbs of the body, like we spoke earlier. Everyone has their uniqueness, their unique flow, their unique light, and also a husband and a wife. When we say it's your second half, okay, your second half means, yeah, I'm marrying the second half of my soul, the second half, like Adam, the second half of his guf that has been separated. Now, it doesn't mean that somebody who's not married is a flawed, broken person and there's no life in singlehood. Chas v'shalom to say that. Sometimes singles feel, you know, like people look at me like I'm this broken, incomplete, flawed person. I have no life till I'm married. That's not fair and it's not true. But it means that there is something deep, deep in the person's soul that comes to its full fruition and actualization with that connection with the other. I have to tell you a brilliant word from my brilliant wife, okay, whom some of you know. She told me one day that what does it mean you're marrying your second half? So most people think it means you're marrying your second half, right? Another person who's your second half. She says it also means the second half inside of you that you never knew about and your spouse helps you find out about those parts of you that you never learned about. Good, huh? Yeah, you see, I chose well. Yeah, I chose well. Everything I teach is basically what I heard from her, more or less. I'm not joking. But the bottom line is, in other words, it's not just I getting a second half, which is also powerful, but it's really my own second half that I would have never had access to. That's why our spouses trigger us like no one else. So we get upset. But really, it's an opportunity to heal those parts that we never dealt with. If we embrace that opportunity during marriage, great. If not, God gives us one more opportunity, our children. My spouse, I could say, oh, it's your fault, it's your issue. With your children, usually we grow up. Like, maybe I have to see what's going on inside of me. And that's why it says in Sfarim that marriage is a second birth. It's like the neshama coming down a second time. What does that mean? Every neshama comes down and it has tikkun to do. It has something to fix. If I take on the tikkun, great. And if not, my spouse. It's like a rebirth of going into my own second half. And as a result of that, the ramifications of that are very powerful. If somebody's upset with their spouse, somebody is having unresolved issues with their spouse, it's very easy to say, you have a problem, you have an issue, you go get therapy, you're just like your mother. That's a bad one, I know. Do not practice this at home. Do not tell this to your husband. He may be just like his mother, but I don't know his mother, so I'm not going to get involved in local politics. But the point is, we have to be sensitive. However, the key is very often what we're saying here really is that if I'm in a conflict with my spouse, I'm really in a conflict with myself. And that's why divorce in Judaism, even though it's an option, and there's the halachas of divorce, and sometimes it's tragically necessary, but we see it as a tragedy. We don't see it as an option. I don't go into a doctor and say, oh, I have an infection in my hand. You know, if you can heal it, good. If not, just cut off my hand. You don't do that. Sometimes there's amputation to save a life. Sometimes. But marriage is treated with such sanctity. And divorce is treated with such sensitivity. Because it's not just, I had a friend, and now I moved out. Yiddish guy doesn't see it that way. It's a very, very serious, serious decision if there's no other choice. Sometimes it's necessary. And then the Torah says how to get divorced, how to give a get. But if not, don't consider it as an option. No, don't get married. And if it doesn't work out, we're going to get divorced. And I would say it's one of the things that's missing in the secular society today. Why so many divorces happen. It's because the foundation of marriage is missing. The foundation of marriage is that hopefully, Be'ezer Hashem, you're encountering you yourself in your other. And therefore, are we having issues? Maybe, and we have to work things out. And if I'm having issues with myself, so what? I'm going to tell the doctor to kill me? I'm going to go to Dr. Kevorkian and tell him to put me to sleep because I'm having issues with myself? I'm having issues with myself, I'm going to work it out. I'm having issues with my spouse, let's work it out. Because we're working out something that affects each one of us very, very deep. And again, I'm going to say this because we have to be sensitive. Sometimes divorce is tragically necessary and sometimes it may even save lives. Especially when there's real, real abuse or horrendous stuff. And shame on those men or women who hold back a get and torture their spouse. Torture their spouse by years and years of not giving a get or not taking a get. It's shame on them and a disgrace on any person who supports them and helps them out committing this type of evil towards the mother or father of their children. And as a result of that, a person sees it differently. So marriage is really, it's not me versus you. I did it this time, you do it tomorrow. I scored points today, you score points tomorrow. I want to go here, you want to go here, let's compromise. Maybe that's a stage in life, but it represents really a painful reality. In the deeper sense of marriage, there is a real, real trust, a real, real bond where two people, even though they're different, can truly create space for the other and realize that in that space, they will not lose themselves. They will find themselves. Again, if I developed coping mechanisms of loneliness, I may not know how to do this. It may be very, very scary for me, but I have to identify it as a wound and then have the ability to be able to heal. So now, after this, we understand Machtzis HaShekel, don't we? Now we get it. Now both answers are very, very clear. The Torah wants you not to give a half a shekel. The Torah wants me to give a whole shekel. But the question is, who's me? Who am I? If I am I, then I have a question. I'm giving a half a shekel, why not give a whole shekel? But if we just explain that who is the real I? The I is you and me. You and I are one. So if you tell me to give a whole shekel, it's like telling me half of you should give a whole shekel. Why should half of me give a whole shekel? So the Torah says 20 geira. You're not giving 10 geira, you're giving 20 geira. Doesn't say 10, it says 20. But who's giving the 20 geira? You. Who's you? You and the other. It's really one. It's not a fake thing. It's not fiction. We don't talk about achdos, you know, let's be nice to each other. On the contrary, when we're truly true to ourselves, we're one. When there's blockages, that's when we become separate. So therefore, the mitzvah of Machtzis HaShekel is that the true I is giving a whole shekel. The true I is always you and me together. I'm a half, you're a half together. And take a look now at the Chasam Sofer. I'm not going to call this a feministic Chasam Sofer because the Chasam Sofer would not appreciate that term and I'm not going to use that term. But it's quite astonishing what he says. It's the last source. Chasam Sofer Kisisa. Listen what he says. Be'egel shum isha loy chata. By the sin of the golden calf, not one woman was involved. Not one. There was not one woman who contributed jewelry or was involved. Not only did they not participate, they actually told their husbands, I will not come back to you until you come back to yourself. You're being insane. You're being irresponsible. You're being meshuggah. We're finished. When you're ready to come back and be normal again, we're going to come back. That's what Sofer says. Nimtza ki nivgam chatzi adam, hu nefesh kol zachar, ach loy nefesh shum isha. So in the relationships and all the marriages, who was blemished? a half of the soul, only the man. If a man and a woman are two halves of one soul, so half of it was blemished, the masculine, not the feminine. Loi nefesh shumisha, ki im ben zuga, her marriage partner, not her. Al kein sivahu yizbarich yitnu machtzis hashekel. So Hashem said, when you want to atone, give a half a shekel. Shehu kol ish al atzmoi. Every man for himself. Ach loy shekel sholem. Don't give a whole shekel. Ki baz zuge shu chetzi ha'acher loy nivgam. Because his spouse, his other half, she's good. Why should she give a half a shekel? Vuhu atzorech kofir nafshei. Loy he. He's the one who needs an atonement. That's why, yeah, some people say Machzitz HaShekel, the first, every year Machzitz HaShekel was men and women, but the first year, it says, right, those from 20 and up, Kala Ever El Apkodim, men should give from 20 and up. First of all, why not younger than 20? Why men? Now we see. It's not an insult to women, it's a compliment to women. It's people who are married. And because they're married, it's two halves. And one half was blemished, Machzitz HaShekel. And therefore, he has to atone. But now let's go one step deeper. Take a look in the second, so it's going to be our last point. Wow. Okay, we really having a good time today. Yerushalmi Shkolim Perek Beis Halacha Gimel. I should say a meaningful time today. I stand corrected. Yerushalmi Shkolim Perek Beis Halacha Gimel. Talmud Yerushalmi Shkolim. Repinchas B'Shem Reb Levi. Repinchas said in the name of Reb Levi, Lefisha Machru B'Chayr Shol Rachel Be'estrim Kesef. The Jewish people sold the oldest son of Rachel, Be'estrim Kesef, Yosef, v'nafa l'chol echad ve'echad mehen tiba, l'fichach ye'kol echad ve'echad mehen noisen shikloi tiba. Reb Pinchas gives a whole new reason for Machzitz HaShekel. In Parshas Vayeshev it says, they took Yosef from the pit, they sold him to the Ishmaelites who were going to Egypt. How much did they sell Yosef for? Esrim Kesef. 20 silver coins. So Chazal say that added up to 5 shkalim. 20 silver coins added up to 5 shkalim. How many brothers were involved in the sale of Yosef? 10. So if they had 5 shkalim and they split it up between 10 brothers, what did everybody get? A half a shekel. So that's why we're giving a half a shekel. We call it lechaper al nafshei seichem, to atone. It's basically Jews giving back the money that they once stole when they sold Yosef into slavery. Everybody went home with a machzitz HaShekel. I once saw an article in a newspaper. It was a secular newspaper. Somebody interviewed a Satmar woman, and she was like 65 or so. And he said to her, are you jealous of women who leave the house at 8 o'clock in the morning? They serve as judges or lawyers. They go to the courthouse. They're there 8:45 with their attaché case dressed up. And I see you raised, 13 kids, and you must be so jealous and envious. So she tells the reporter, she says, actually not. Come Friday night and you'll see I have 60 grandchildren who worship me. Everybody is jealous of me. They worship me. So basically, according to this Talmud Yerushalmi, the Jewish people are giving Machzitz HaShekel. They're giving back the half a shekel they got for the sale of Yosef. How does that come? It's a fascinating commentary, and it's pretty actually not very well known. But what's the idea? Like, what's this idea that we're atoning for this by giving a Machzitz HaShekel? How does it work? But now we can understand it perfectly clear. What was the thought process when they sold Yosef? Let's think about the thought process for a moment. So the brothers looked at each other, and they say in Parshas Vayeshev, "Lechu v'nashlicheu ba'achad haboyrus." Let's kill him, nargeu. Let's kill him. Throw him into one of the pits. V'nira mayiu chalei Yosef, and we'll see what happens to his dreams. Basically, the message was: life without him will be much easier, much simpler. We have one brother who's really a rotten potato, the black sheep in the family, pun intended. And if we could only get rid of him, We won't have this competition. We won't have somebody dreaming that we're all going to bow down to him. We don't have somebody who has these dreams that he's going to be our king and we're going to be his slaves and subjects. We're not going to have this kid who's getting all the love of Tati and we're getting nothing. We're chopped liver. We're not going to have this kid who's going to remind us and remind Tati about all of our failures and all of our issues. Life will be normal without him. Just get rid of him. That's the thought process. And they get rid of him. They get a little money. They go home. As always, God has the last laugh. Reality has the last laugh. It turns out as follows. If not for Yosef, not only would they not have had a peaceful life, not only would they not have had a non-peaceful life, without Yosef they would have all died from hunger. So it's not just Yosef was a brother. Without Yosef, it turns out, none of them would live. The only reason they can all live, and Yaakov, was because of Yosef. Because he became the prime minister and he figured out how to put away food during the times of hunger and he fed them. So suddenly, as life moves on, as history moves on, after they sell Yosef, they come home. Yaakov is grieving. Yaakov is in mourning. They suddenly realize they made a mistake. There's no peace in the family. The family is broken. But they still don't understand why. Later they see, if not for Yosef being in Egypt, none of them would survive. Their whole future dependent on Yosef. So imagine two brothers who get into a fight, they stop talking to each other. One looks at the other brother and says, I don't like you, I hate you, I'm done with you. I'm done with you. And then the other brother, who's actually maybe an innocent person, but okay, his brother doesn't want to talk to him. And then one day, this brother who threw him away suddenly needs a kidney transplant. And the only match he has is his brother. And suddenly he realizes it's time to look at things differently. Maybe getting rid of you was not the solution. Maybe getting rid of you was really getting rid of me, getting rid of my future. That's what the brothers discovered. The brothers discovered that Yosef HaTzadik was an indispensable part of the family, an indispensable part of the symphony. Getting rid of him meant getting rid of themselves, getting rid of their second half, getting rid of their future, getting rid of their destiny. They needed to expand their horizons and create space for a Yosef rather than narrow their horizons and exclude Yosef. Yosef was not their enemy. Yosef was their potential to expand. Yosef was their potential to change the world. Yosef was their potential to transform society. Yosef was the paradigm of ultimately nourishing a whole world during the time of famine. Yosef can teach them something about themselves that they didn't know. This is what Yosef told them. You thought you're going to selling me. Really, Hashem kilamichyos lachani alikim lefneichem. Really, Hashem sent me to be able to bring life to you. And it's interesting, and this I'm going to conclude with, there's two Talmuds that are studied, Talmud Bavli, Talmud Yerushalmi, the Babylonian Talmud, the Jerusalem Talmud. And it's different paths, it's different cycles, different styles. There's only one tractate, one Masechta, that's from Yerushalmi, and it made it into all the prints of Talmud Bavli. Even the first print of Shas, of Gemara, was 1522. In Venice, 1522, Venice, Italy. That's 30 years after the expulsion from Spain. It's the first printing press came out then. First Talmud, even in that first print, one tractate made it in from Yerushalmi into Bavli. And therefore, those who learn Daf Yomi, Talmud Bavli, they don't learn Talmud Yerushalmi. Besides that tractate, which tractate? Shkalim, Masechta Shkalim. Masechta Shkalim. Why? So the Rebbe said, because Shkalim represents that we're two halves, we're one. So even Bavli and Yerushalmi ultimately come together in Masechta Shkalim. And even those who learn the Babylonian Talmud, they learn Masechta Shkalim from Talmud Yerushalmi. Because Talmud Yerushalmi captures that truth of eternal, essential oneness. Have a beautiful week. Thank you. Wow. Thank you. Very nice. Very nice. Invading God's outlet. If I'm an outlet of Hashem, so this is invading God's outlet.
Do you think it's right?
Rabbi Soloveitchik's book, Adank Farnkomen, Rabbi Soloveitchik's book, The Lonely Man of Faith, it has a lot of beautiful points, but I think at its core, it's rooted in a sense of sadness. Rabbi Sachs, Rabbi Jonathan Sachs, Olav Hashalom, wrote an article and said, he said that the Tanya had a different vision of reality. Was macht er? Okay. Yeah. Yeah. Das ist Chassidus. This is ganz Chassidus. Achdus Hashem. How do you know that's not what Hashem wants? I don't know. I don't know that the word is Hashem wants us all in therapy, but I think Hashem wants us all to work through our pnimius. Let's understand. That's why we all need to support each other and give each other access. You're right. You're right, I know. That's why we need people like yourself and your ilk to change the paradigms and to become sources of influence.
It feels too small always.
It's not. It's not. You never know. You never know. You don't have to play God. You have to be you. And when everyone radiates their own light, things happen beyond our imagination. No, it's not enough. They still need tools. They need the tools of how to deal with triggers. They need the tools of how to deal with their pain. They need the tools of how to access this information in daily life. If not, it just remains a nice shear. Especially access to the nervous. The nervous system doesn't come to the shear. The nervous system, I don't have to tell you, has its own rules. So if I don't have ways of dealing with my nervous system, which is the way that my mind communicates with my body, it all remains abstract. Yeah. But you're helping people, yeah?
Right, but then there's people that I'm not helping. That
I understand.
It's too hard. They can't find. They don't know how.
I understand.
And how many clients did I see already? Just a few. Also,
I understand. There's also, you know, there's something called the tipping point. You heard about the tipping point? There's a point where there's going to be such awareness, an explosion, and it's going to be a tipping point. The Rambam says you have to see every mitzvah. You know, the Rambam says like the world is an equal scale, like shekel. And one mitzvah tips it, and the whole world changes. And this also, there's going to be a tipping point. In other words, now, a little more awareness, a little more, at some point, there's going to be a tipping point where it's like, it's going to be like oxygen. What is it? Give me water, show me. So, realize that. But that's what happens. Reality pushes until it gets through the dam. No, there's a dam blocking the water, blocking the flow. At some point, the current becomes so powerful, the pressure builds up and it mounts against the wall and it breaks through the dam and then everybody will be running for healing. So get ready. A lot of atzlacha. It's an honor to have you. I see how you take in the information. The Rebbe's last sicha. This is the Rebbe's last sicha. Mamar's the last sicha. This was Mamar's the Rebbe's last sicha. Yes. Mamar's the last sicha the Rebbe ever said was this nekuda. And he went on to a whole different inyan. I didn't begin to have time, but this was the last sicha. Yeah. Yeah, you're welcome. Thank you. Thank you for coming.
I appreciate it so much. My mother, she was so beautiful.
Amazing.
This class is brought to you by theyeshiva.net. Please help us continue the classes. Make even a small contribution at www.theyeshiva.net/donate.